You're now listening to Sound Talent Media. Check out more shows at soundtalentmedia.com.
Hey everybody, this is Lizzie Hale from Hailstorm.
Hey, what's up? This is Chadis from Hell Yeah and Mudvayne.
This is Ron Bumblefoot Fall.
Hey, this is Barb Ann Wild.
And this is Daniela Clark.
This is Johnny from Art of Dying.
Hey, this is Mixie from Stitched Up Heart.
Hey, this is Nick Reese from Joyous Bowl.
Hey, this is Josh from Bad Flower. Welcome aboard. The ship making way is fuck!
Hey, this is Ralph Sutton.
This is Aaron Jones.
What's going on, gang? Zach Wild here. And you're listening to Making Waves, the Shipwrecked Podcast.
Making Waves.
Hey, everyone. Welcome aboard Making Waves, the Shipwrecked Podcast. In this episode number 55, our hosts, Chad and Justin, went into the depths of the horror movie genre with iconic actor Bill Moseley, who turns out is a pretty prolific musician as well. Anyway, I hope you enjoy the episode, and remember to rock hard and vacation harder.
Bill, to start, I've got to ask, how does someone from Yale who goes into journalism kind of transition into acting?
Well, if you could see New Haven, Connecticut in the winter, you'd realize why I acted every winter, just to kind of beat the monotony and the everything is gray and white with snow, gray with soot. The only color in New Haven during the winter is yellow, and that's from dogs pissing in snowbanks. So, you know, you got to do something to beat those student blues. And so I acted every that was the main time I would act is just in the winter to kind of, you know, pass the time. But I always acted. I was my parents used to be part of I come from outside of Chicago, a town called Barrington, Illinois, and they were part of the Barrington Play Reading Group. So when I was a little kid, my parents and some other parents, you know, six or seven parents, would put on plays in their houses. And they would have a dinner party, and then they would put on a play in their living room. And they would hold the script in their hand, but they would, you know, wear costumes and make a set and everything. It was very cool. The Barrington Play Reading Group. And I was often enlisted as what if they needed a kid, like in the lottery or Sunrise at Campobello or A Thousand Clowns, for which I won like a tiny Oscar for playing a Nick in A Thousand Clowns. So, you know, that too is always kind of in my blood, but I'm from the Midwest, man. You know, good old Midwestern stock where you don't really think of acting or writing for that matter as a career. You know, you think of it as an avocation, something fun to do, but you know, if you're going to make money, you're going to go to work and by golly, swing that pickaxe or whatever they were expecting of me. So the fact that I even got, you know, was able to, you know, make a career out of journalism was a real, you know, big break for the most.
For the journalism itself, that obviously you have to delve into research and factual evidence when you're writing your articles. Was there ever a creative like narrative writer or like creative writing person in school, or did this kind of just, was it one of those things where you just got out of school and you don't know what the hell you're going to do with yourself? And I'll just do journalism. Or was it
When I first got out, I was an English major. And yes, when I was in fourth grade, I won first prize for a fiction called Diney the Dinosaur, about a little triceratops that was very much like me, that was always, you know, crying wolf and, you know, pissing off the tribe. And finally, they send Diney into exile. And Diney sees that there's a Tyrannosaurus coming to eat the other Triceratopses. Mm-hmm. And so Diney comes back and they don't believe him. So Diney goes out, this little poor little Triceratops, and fights the Tyrannosaurus and kills the Tyrannosaurus. He gets bitten but he kills the Tyrannosaurus and the tribe, you know, lauds him and he becomes the chief of the tribe. That was my fantasy. Great.
That's and great.
I did so well with that the next year I followed up with Orny the Ornitholestes, which is another dinosaur. So, I mean, I knew a good thing when I saw it. So, I've always written creatively. But, you know, I didn't, that wasn't really where I was able to make a living at the time when I got out of college. Actually, what I did was I went right from Connecticut to Boston. And when I was there, I was a copywriter for an ad agency. And that felt like looking, you know, kind of looking into the gaping maw of hell. So I got out of that. I just thought, oh my God, is this what I, you know, is this why I've gone and become an English major? Is that to sell, you know, Purity Supreme supermarkets? And, you know, I had fun doing it. I mean, I think it's a wonderful profession if you're into it, but I just figured there's got to be something else. I don't know. That was my little yearning.
Would you ever lean into the greeting card business, do you think, at this point in your life?
You know, I feel like with all of this, I'm good at picking greeting cards for other people. So I'm certainly a big fan of greeting cards, you know, funny, weird, inappropriate greeting cards, you know. So I don't know. I mean, if push came to shove, I think they're probably worse fates than writing greeting cards.
I just think there's something beautiful about it. Personally, that's what I'm trying to achieve in my life is just the ability. Just one. I want to be published in one, maybe two of my own greeting cards.
That's, you can do that now, right? You can, you know, get on TikTok and, you know, become a greeting card millionaire.
Yeah.
I can make dancing elf videos.
Is Omni magazine still around?
Zombie magazine?
Omni.
No, it's no long gone. Omni was one of the first magazines that actually went online. And I don't think they really had worked out an advertising scheme because they didn't seem to last very long.
Yeah.
But Omni was, boy, that was my bread and butter. I would say that was the spine of my freelance writing career in New York City.
Yeah.
Cause you know what I did? Cause I loved science. I mean, when I was in college, I took a couple of courses. One was black holes and quasi-stellar phenomena for the non-scientist and quantum mechanics for the non-scientist. I mean, I was interested in it, but I didn't want to have to go to graduate school for 10 years to figure out what they were talking about. Yeah. And so I always loved science, and I got my opportunity to interview people for Omni. And, you know, I had a great editor there who loved me and just, you know, kept giving me assignments, and I would bring in ideas and she would say, yes, we'll give you, you know, $5,000 to fly to Costa Rica to talk to somebody about bugs. And I was totally into it, man. That was great.
Well, real quick, while we have this little short little break here. Hey, welcome everyone. We are now live to Facebook. Thank you for joining us on this special Wednesday evening edition of Making Waves with our guest, Bill Moseley. Not our usual musical fare, but however, that's a contradiction because he does have some music in his professional career. So we'll talk about that. But everyone, welcome. Make sure to pose your questions to us on the thread, and we'll get to a few of those. But right now, we're going to continue our conversation with Mr. Moseley here. And if you guys don't know him, and I can't imagine if you haven't seen one of his movies or something he's been in, he is kind of the anti-hero with some of his characters, including Chop Top from Texas Chainsaw Massacre 2. And most of you probably know him as Otis B. Driftwood. From the Rob Zombie trilogy. And I think most popular was probably The Devil's Rejects for a lot of folks. And Three from Hell, obviously, is the same thing. But he's got an incredible new film, and I hope you guys have seen the trailer, called Prisoners of the Ghostland with Nick Cage. And if you guys haven't seen this thing, I'll let Bill explain it further. But from my eye, it's like Samurai meets the Wild West, almost a spaghetti Western Wild West. It's completely gonzo, but considering you're in it and Mr. Cage is in it, it's kind of fully expected of the two of you. And it's somebody that's kind of a character that's a little bit different from what we expect from you lately. And could you just talk to people about this film? Because it looks incredible.
Yes. Well, first of all, thank you for having me on. It's great to be here. And hello, Facebook. Prisoners of the Ghostland. I think it's coming out maybe middle of September. I think September 17th was what I saw in the trailer. The trailer dropped today. It looks fantastic. I'm the guy in the white suit and the big beard and the white cowboy hat and the red gloves. And I play the governor in Prisoners of the Ghostland. I think I guess I'm the bad guy. Jeez, what a shock. But getting the job was great. I'm friends with writer, producer Reza Sixto Safai, S-A-F-A-I, who's also on Facebook. And Reza had come to see, I invited him to come to see Three from Hell. Rob Zombie is the last of the trilogy that Rob, or let's say so far, I don't know. We seem to survive at the end of it. But anyway, so Reza came to see that, saw me as playing Otis with a big beard and, you know, whatever I was doing. And said, you know, I've got this great part. We're going to go shoot this movie. It's starring Nick Cage and it's shooting in Japan. And I was like, whoa, you know, like definitely count me in, man. You know, if it were, you know, with Nick Cage, I mean, even if they were shooting in, you know, a phone booth in Duluth, they, you know, I'd be more than happy to walk there myself backwards and just, you know, have a chance to work with him. A big fan of his. I just love, especially the more recent stuff like Mandy, Color Out of Space. I see Pig. I haven't seen the movie yet, but it looks fantastic. So I was all for it. And I got to Japan. It was very coincidental because my wife and I had just taken a cruise up the Mekong River from Ho Chi Minh City, the former Saigon, Vietnam, up to, we were on the water all the way up to Phnom Penh, Cambodia. And so we were in the vicinity and, you know, they had some different start dates for Prisoners of the Ghostland. And it turns out I was able to have my cruise up the river with my wife and then get on a plane and fly to Tokyo and take the bullet train. I'm a big train guy down to Maibara, which is a little town on the banks of Lake Biwa. And for horror fans, that's where, I guess it was the green gargantua came out of Lake Biwa. So I was very excited. I'm a big kaiju fan too. So, you know, I was very excited to be at Lake Biwa. And we shot this wonderful movie. My character is kind of capitalism, you know, everything that's wrong with America, the capitalism, I don't know, something, but I'm some kind of archetype, I like to think. And Nick Cage plays a prisoner. My granddaughter, quote unquote, has escaped into something called, Ghostland, which is a place. This is a kind of a futuristic dystopia. And Ghostland is where all of the bad people and the radiated people, I mean, all kinds of crazy, you know, kind of spirit people are located, and she has escaped into the ghost land. And I get Nick Cage out to get him out of jail to go off and fetch her and bring her back in 5 days. He wears this incredible suit, this bodysuit, looks like leathers from an Italian motorcycle racer. Except the only difference is that it has little bomb clusters at very strategic parts of the body, including over his testicles. And there's also a little meter on his wrist that, you know, if he is about to harm or hit my granddaughter, you know, his arm will blow off. If he has some sexual intentions, well, you know, something else will blow off. So he's got, it's, you know, there's a time, there's certainly a bunch of peril, and, you know, and it's a great movie. We actually got selected for Sundance back in February, and that was quite an honor. Unfortunately, of course, it was Zoom dance as opposed to actually going to Utah, but it was a very great honor, and I'm really excited. This is going to be a real fun ride for you know, fans of just about everything.
I got to ask you, with your energy and his energy together, and what was that like on set? I mean, it seems almost uncontainable.
You know, he was such a great guy to work with. I was worried that he was going to, you know, say, Bill, who, and, you know, is that the way you're going to do it? You know, in other words, I had worries that, you know, he's such a, you know, he's an Oscar winner, man. So I figured that he, you know, I was a little timid. And he just turned out to be the greatest guy. Really a lot of fun. You know, we swapped a couple of stories over the, you know, it was freezing there. So we had like a little, couple of little, you know, folding chairs and a, you know, and a flame heater that we'd kind of warm our hands while we waited for another setup. And, yeah, he was a great guy. Really, really liked him a lot. So as it turned out, he's into it. I was into it. You know, and that's really all you can ask. If you have the misfortune of working with somebody who's more concerned about, you know, what's my better side and, you know, all that kind of stuff, all those concerns, you know, that can, you know, kind of color the experience. But with Nick, he just pounded it out. Really good. Really a lot of fun. Knew his stuff, man. He was awesome. I would certainly love to work with him 100 more times.
Yeah. One of the characters, before I let Chad come, I want to ask you about was Otis Driftwood, which is something you're really known for. And people very much treat you as a hero, not any hero at certain points. But the point of mass murders, we think of like kind of like rednecky kind of things, and there was obviously the element, but there's also a massive intelligence to him. He's more of a thinking man's murderer kind of thing. It always seemed to me like you were like always, you always had some sort of like machine going in your head. It was always going to, you weren't just going to talk. You were going to basically give sermons and everything else. So this is a highly intelligent criminal. Was that something that Rob left you to do? Or you just kind of said, hey, you know what? I think I'm going to go this way. Or was that something that Rob had intended for the character to be like highly intellectual?
I think that's all Rob. I mean, you know, when he first approached me to play Otis, what I thought, and I was mistaken, was that what Rob wanted was kind of a chop top redo, you know, like, so kind of his own version of chop top. And I remember, kind of coming at Otis originally, you know, for House of a Thousand Corpses, kind of coming in that, from that direction. And Rob gently but firmly like pried my hands off Chop Top, because Chop Top was my character, my known character, you know, and like Chop Top, I'm Chop Top, you know, and thank God he did, you know, because I mean, I'm, you know, there's Chop Top, you know, and in all of us, I suppose. But, you know, with Otis, it was a totally different body center. I mean, I think of Chop Top as up in the shoulders, like, you know, with a coat hanger and they lick my plate, you know, all up here. With Otis, it was right down in the crotch, man. It was like two thumbs in the belt buckle and like, fuck you. You know, he's like bigger than life, kind of a, so like a Western hero in part, an artist, crazy. And with no remorse, shame or hesitation about anything, which I thought was really, you know, wow, how refreshing is that? Yeah. Where it's like, I you know, cite, let's say Devil's Rejects when Lou Temple is saying, you know, I'm taking Banjo and Sullivan out to the kill site. And I say, well, you know, that's the end of the line. And Lou goes, wait a minute. Well, but you said, but Mr. You know, we did what you said, you know, and expecting me to like say, oh yeah, you're right. You can go free. And instead I go, you know, I didn't say that. And anyway, you know, I'm just like, just going straight ahead, no remorse, no shame, no colors of that, just straight ahead, man. I just think that's the best.
Agreed. And you nailed it.
I am the devil. I'm here to do the devil's work. I mean, wow. You know, and Rob, you know, those are all Rob Zombie lines. So pretty cool. Just, all you got to do is just, you know your lines, hit your marks. And, you know, what comes through is, you know, Rob and Bill, and it's all kinds of stuff. And, you know, it's one of those things where it just, that character just, you know, comes out.
Yeah.
And people are a little worried, like, you know, what happens when you go home at the end of the day, you know, and I have two daughters and a, you know, wife and stuff like that, a dog, cats, you know, and so what happens when Otis goes home from a hard day at the office? But, you know, I mean, I've learned that, you know, when they say cut, you know, they really mean it. And I'm not a method actor in the sense that I don't have to stay Otis, you know, 24/7. So that's good for my family.
Hey, before we get Chad, we do have a question I'd like to get to, if you don't mind. Sure. Karen, she wants to know, in high school, what would your peers say that you were most likely to be or do, and were they correct?
Well, I went to a prep school in Connecticut called Hotchkiss. And, you know, in the yearbook, the year, my senior year, I was voted for two things. One was gets caught with the most. And the other one is writes most, gets least. Because I was lonely, and I guess I was writing a lot of letters to girls at girls' schools or whatever. So gets caught with the most, you know, and I don't know if that answers the question, but, you know, I was already into like kind of horrors. At the prep school, I was the president of the Saturday evening music committee, just because in our new auditorium, there was a cool turntable, and I would put on like MC5 and stuff, which kind of shocked everybody back then.
From Detroit.
And, I was also vice president of the medical committee, you know, medical club. It was a club. And that was because we were able to show stuff like, you know, like Philadelphia Emergency Ward and, you know, horrible movies and people with coming in with knives in their heads and stuff like that.
Bill's path was set at a much early age.
That's right. It's true. So I hope that answers her question.
Yeah, Karen, I think she's satisfied with that answer. Thank you.
I was going to make a note, like, I've been going through your entire filmography and your television appearances and everything before we got started. And I don't think I really realized just how many scary films, horror films, you know, these parts that you've played from essentially the onslaught of your start of your career here. Was it something you planned on when you were thinking about being an actor to go into the horror genre? Or is it just kind of like, this is where your mind just sort of like pushed things at the time and then you stay?
Well, I didn't really have a plan to go into any aspect of movie making. What I ended up doing was, you know, I was still a horror fan. So I got freaked out by the Texas Chainsaw Massacre. I think I saw it in 75 or 6. And it freaked me out so much that I ended up, you know, seeing it a bunch of times to try to make it familiar, and that didn't seem to work. It just made it worse. And finally, I made a short film called The Texas Chainsaw Manicure, which is about 5 minutes. Woman goes into the beauty parlor, gets her hair done, sitting under the dryer, wants a manicure, and out comes Leatherface with the chainsaw and starts sawing her fingers, and she screams and passes out. And when they, you know, slap her too, she goes, she's got a fabulous manicure. And she goes out to her husband in the truck, played by me in a cameo, with a wine mark, looking like the hitchhiker from the original Chainsaw. And she goes, look, honey, I got the best manicure ever. And I go, hey, that's great, honey. We should celebrate with some head cheese. And I bought a bunch of, you know, a hunk of head cheese. And anyway, a friend of mine showed that to Toby Hooper. And based on my literally 20-second cameo as the hitchhiker, I got the job of Chop Top. I was not a showbiz guy. I wasn't on a showbiz trajectory. My wife, who is, you know, was on Broadway, and, you know, that's all she wanted to be when she was a kid and everything. So that's like the more normal path. Mine was like, you know, winning the lottery.
Iconic eccentric actor in Dennis Hopper. I mean, that must have been at that early point in your career, running into him, that acting across from him must have been a learning, and then be also intimidating as hell.
Not really. We were so tired. I mean, literally we were working like 20 hour days, me and Billy Johnson, Leatherface, and Jim Seidow, the cook. And, we were just, you know, they were just working our butts off. And the only time I remember seeing Dennis Hopper, we were all staying at the same motor lodge outside of Austin. And we came in for like, you know, breakfast one more time, and we were just beat. And there was Dennis Hopper in his bathrobe, you know, sipping a cup of coffee. And he was just putting his golf clubs into the trunk of his rented Lincoln Continental. And he was about to go off and play golf with Willie Nelson, because Willie, you know, owned that golf club in Austin. And so that was kind of my only experience of Dennis Hopper, until, of course, the finale when he jumps in and we have our, you know, our big brouhaha in the chainsaw dining room. So I wasn't really that intimidated just because I was literally exhausted the whole time. I mean, they just worked our butts off.
It's interesting to think about that time period. Just putting myself in what you just said, I can't believe that you were at that stage then, where like you were so tired that the moment that this moment that happened, it's kind of like, meh, whatever. I just want to get through this next scene. That's an interesting thing. I think about as a musician, I think about that a lot, like being in the studio or on the road or whatever on stage. And somebody said, "Was it cool to meet this person?" And you're like, "Yeah, it was great. It was cool. I didn't really think about it because I was literally dripping in sweat and just walked off stage or whatever, and it was cool that they were there, you know?"
Yeah.
Interesting moments, for sure. Speaking of music, I don't know if how many people know this out there in Shiprock land, but you've been creating tunes currently. You have a record that you're working on that's going to come out soon, and you have records that came out previous to this. Could you tell us a little bit about something in the music space, like how you got started? Was it guitar, piano? What really kicked you off there?
My mom made me take piano lessons as a kid, and I never really liked it. And what I used to do is we used to have to go to Sunday school, and I would sit there in the front of the car, and I would, you know, be beating on the dashboard of the car. And so she would say NND, which meant no nervous drumming. And, I went over to a Halloween party at a friend's house, and my friend Christopher English and his dad was the editor of Downbeat magazine, which is an old jazz magazine. And Christopher, this is maybe sixth or seventh grade, had bongos in his room. And I started hitting the bongos and I found my instrument. My music, you know, we always sang in the car. We were a musical family. My older brother, Bruce, plays bass. My younger brother, R.I.P. Dan, was a piano player. And so we formed a band called the Mosley Brothers Band. And had a great time. That was like, we would, you know, through all the family calamities, the Mosley Brothers, you know, that music was strong and really was a great bond. And years later, I moved to Los Angeles and met a guy named Buckethead. And Buckethead was a big Chop Top fan from Chainsaw 2, and wanted me to come down to his, you know, like a studio. He had like an apartment with some equipment. And go off on some of the guitar riffs he'd done. So I was happy to do it. I brought my bongos and, you know, we kind of riffed and had a great time. And out of that, he invited me to come to New York and play on an album called Giant Robot. And so I showed up and did a couple of songs. One was called Onions Unleashed. I insisted they'd spell it O-N-L-E-A-S-H-E-D instead of U. On Onions Unleashed. I don't know. Anyway, note as a small footnote. But anyway, we did that. I Come in Peace. And that started us. And then I was starting to do horror conventions. And I wanted to do more than just sign and sell 8x10. So I thought, called up Buckethead and said, let's make some music so that I can, you know, sell cassettes back then. And so he was down with that. So we went to his rehearsal studio and started jamming and came up with some tunes. And one day we were, you know, doing some videotaping at his mom's house in Oxnard, California, wherever it was. And we were, and his mom had like a vegetable garden, and I was like goofing around in the corn, and I grabbed an ear of corn to kind of make it like I was talking to a microphone. I was going, "Hey, call the cars, call the cops!" And then I looked down, and there was a bunch of bugs on that on the corn cob, and I was, "Corn bugs, corn bugs!" And Buckethead, you know, recognized that as the name of our band, so that's how the corn bugs were born.
8 years or something, right? That you guys were,
yeah, yeah.
You guys were,
and we never did a second take. Everything, and that's not an excuse. That's I don't know if it's my dad used to say, "You're bragging or complaining," but we just cranked them out, man. We just sometimes I would bring some lyrics, other times I would just make them up on the spot, but we just cranked them out and ended up with quite a lot of songs. Some good, some, you know, it's all corn bugs.
It's all corn bugs.
Oh, the musical projects worked on was the four song EP Songs of Death and Despair, or Dark, is it Darkness and Despair or Death and Despair with Phil and Sama?
Yeah, either way is good. Darkness and Despair. I mean, if you want to get literal.
Now, how did that come to be? Are you guys friends because of his interest in horror films and all that kind of, you kind of got together that way? What was the genesis of that one?
I was a fan of Phil's. I mean, certainly a fan of Pantera. And I was asked to interview him for something called Artist Direct. It was a website, and they were doing like actors interviewing musicians and, you know, interviewing each other. And so I said, sure, absolutely. So I came down to interview Phil, and he was going to interview me. And, he ended up knowing a lot more about music, certainly, than I did, and also a lot more about horror movies. So it was kind of like just listening to Phil. I mean, it was like he knew everything. I was shocked. And in fact, just as a side note, I went to his house one time several years ago, and he played me a horror movie I'd never heard of called Defula, D-E-A-F-U-L-A. That is actually, made by and about deaf people with Dracula, like a deaf Dracula. So, I mean, you know, if you're pulling out Defula, you know your shit. So, but I kept saying, yeah, we ought to, jam sometime. And it's kind of like, I realize it's like asking Paul McCartney to, play bass in your garage band. But, one time I just, I would correspond with Phil. He likes to write on email and everything, so we would correspond. And one time I just said, hey man, let's do something. And he said, okay, I got 4 days. If you can get down here, I'm in, north of Lake Pontchartrain and Louisiana. And, and I went, you're on. And I had some air miles, man. I jumped on a plane down to New Orleans and rented a car and found Phil in the woods. And,
So we had
4 days, and I had brought some lyrics again, poems and stuff. And he went through the lyrics, day one, we kind of, said hi and all that kind of stuff. And then, we went into the studio. I think day three was actually the day I was supposed to do all the vocals. And I had gotten a little food poisoning the night before from some funky gumbo. And so I was a little weak the day of the vocals, but I was, still doing okay. And, we were laying stuff down. He was, really liked what I was doing. And then I suddenly had this, urge in my stomach, and I ran out and puked in the bushes. And I remember coming back, I had a beard, and I come back just wiping my mouth and thinking, that's fucking rock and roll, man. So I got back and we finished Bill and Phil, and some couple of really good songs. I think there's six altogether. So six songs. So and I just saw Phil a couple of weeks ago in Indianapolis, and he seems to want to do another one. So that sounds good to me.
Yeah, he's awesome. A prolific artist, bar none. So for sure. And Chad, can you talk to about the Ice Nine Kills?
Yeah, I was going to bring that up. You mentioned interviewing people. So the question I had is, I don't know if you know this or not, but I actually hired you to be in that live stream that my friend Miles directed for the band Ice Nine Kills.
Thanks.
And yeah, no problem. during the pandemic, none the least. So I wanted to ask, how did it feel? I mean, you've been working probably through this in some way, shape or form. You just, making music and obviously making movies, but how did it feel to be like, I guess at the height of this, doing something so at the time, especially so outside of the box for the genre of music, not to even say the entirety of how we consume music in the live stream space. Have you done anything since like that?
I just worked for Ice Nine Kills last week, actually, again. So I have to say yes. I thought it was a lot of fun. The whole COVID thing was a weird deal. Is, I should say, a weird deal. That was a safe set. I think that's, obviously the bottom line. I've been vaccinated, a couple of times already back in Jan and Feb. So I'm cool. I thought that was it was certainly a lot of fun. Thanks again for hiring me.
No problem. More or less, like, we were super excited that you were in, because we had our goals set high. with Bill Moseley. And we're like, well, I don't know what he'll say. So let's reach out. And you're like, let's do it. So the idea of how it all came together. And then I don't know if you watched it at all. If you got to see the
sure, of course, man.
It was really an incredible thing. And they're like a Shiprock family band. They played our cruise before. So it kind of ties the whole room together, you know? Yeah.
I thought you were talking about Shiprock. Is it Arizona or New Mexico? Yeah. Right.
Oh yeah.
Right. That's Shiprock. Yes. All right. No,
I think it's New Mexico actually.
Yeah. It's New Mexico. Cause my wife's cousin, and his wife actually worked on the reservation there as doctors for 10 years. So good old Shiprock.
Shiprock.
Yeah. No, I love Ice Nine Kills. I think it's great. I just, you know, just worked last weekend with Spencer and really had a great time working on, you know, the new, you know, Chucky project, Assault and Batteries. So I love the guy. I love, you know, I mean, I like doing this stuff. You know, if I, you know, sometimes, you know, reputation can be a little cumbersome, like, oh my God, you know, would he do it? It's like, yeah, I would do it because I like to work and I like doing this stuff. And, you know, it sure beats sitting around, you know, staring out the window. I just moved into a house. You know, this is my first house in, I was in my same apartment in Los Angeles for 35 years.
Wow.
And my wife and I bought this house during the pandemic. So it's been, you know, it's been very cool to, you know, be, you know, in a house. And yeah, I like to work. I like to, garden, you know, I mean, now that I'm a, you know,
Whereabouts were you in Los Angeles for 35 years? The same
apartment? Third and Cochran.
Okay.
Third and Cochran is about, it's not even a mile from the Grove. From, you know, Farmer's Market. Go in the other direction. When I moved to Los Angeles back in 1986, the one thing that I knew about LA was I knew because I would, you know, as a kid, I was into dinosaurs. So I knew about the La Brea tar pits. And so when I moved to Los Angeles, that was the one thing I told my then pregnant girlfriend. I said, look, I don't know where we're going to live, but it's got to be within like walking distance of the La Brea tar pits. So that's, you know, that's where we've, you know, we lived there for, you know, I lived there for like, you know, many, many years. And finally, finally bought this house. So it's very, very cool.
Can I ask you, were you paying the same price in rent as when you first bought, started renting?
Do you mean it's like the mortgage here?
Yeah, did you get grandfathered in?
When you first moved to LA and lived in an apartment for 35 years, were you paying the same price at the 35th year you did the first year?
No. I think the price doubled. But, you know, when I moved in there in 1986, the rent was, I think, $875. Jeez. And now it's about just a little under $1,600, which still is pretty great. It's 2-bedroom and, you know, a garage space in the back and, you know, yada, yada, yada.
Yeah, I'd take that $1,600 all day long. I was in downtown Los Angeles and it was like
right now it's insane. Well, everything is insane because I don't know what happened. Somebody stepped on the price accelerator. Everything's more expensive.
It's crazy.
Well, listen, Bill, we've had you for over 30 minutes. We can't thank you enough. It's been a lot of fun and obviously I hope very educational for some of our viewers who aren't familiar with your work, but I'm sure they will be. And hopefully guys out there, if you haven't seen him yet, a good intro to Bill's work is obviously the Rob Zombie films. That's going to be House of a Thousand Corpses, Devil's Rejects, and Three from Hell. Check those out. If you really want to get a little deep on him, check out Repo, the Genetic.
Yeah, there you go. Thank you.
And then also you can see him. And I just know this little thing about him because I did watch an interview with you before. Your first film you ever saw was The Blob, the horror film.
Yeah.
And then
my grandmother took me to it.
He was in the remake of The Blob. So that's called Full Circle. But right now, the most important thing is go check out his new film, The Prisoners of the Ghostland, featuring Mr. Mosley and Nick Cage. If you want to have a gonzo watching party, grab all your friends for that one because it looks crazy. And that comes out here in, I guess, a couple of weeks of September.
Yeah, middle of September. And if they want to get in touch with me on Facebook and Instagram and all that stuff, it's at the little at sign, Chop Top Mosley, M-O-S-E-L-E-Y.
There you go. Go right to the source. Bill, thank you. Right. And we really do appreciate it. Thank you, everyone, for joining us and on Shiprock and Facebook Live stream. Also, guys, remember real quick, I'll go to it. We still have a few cabins left for the cruise, so go to shiprock.com to...
Right on. And don't rock the boat, but definitely buy a ticket.
Yeah, you don't want to miss some of our God and I Prevail and Steel Panther and all your favorites. So we look forward to that. Thank you, Bill.
Wait a minute. I Hate God is on the trip?
No, Lamb of God.
Oh, Lamb of God. Yeah, well, I was, you know, that was,
Hey, let's have Jimmy Bauer on the cruise, you know?
Yes, that's another, the Lamb of God. I mean, I was with her, you know, in the Graves, starring Lamb of God, lead singer.
Oh, Randy?
Randy. Randy was in his horror film debut, The Graves.
The Graves, that's right. That's right.
Good old Randy, man. Say hi to him for me.
Absolutely. Bill, thank you. Best of success with this new film, and always we'll always be looking out for your work. Appreciate
thanks,
it.
Thanks, Justin. Thanks, Chad. And thanks, Jennifer, too, even though you're not visible. And thank you. Thank you, everybody. And maybe I'll see some of you at Monster Mania this weekend in good old Cherry Hill, New Jersey.
There you go. Oh. Home of the Red Devils.
Yes. All right, guys. Thank you very much.
Bye, Bill.
Bye.
Thank you.
EXIT.
I'm Daniela Clark.
I'm Barbara Ann Wild.
And we are the Honest AF Show.
Our podcast is real honest conversation with our celebrity friends and pros.
Covering our anything but average rock and roll lifestyles.
All while tackling the hell that is aging and the battle of beauty.
Oh yeah, nothing is off the table.
The Honest AF Show is available wherever you get your podcasts.